We need to reorganize that and look at that again in our system.
And I wanted to ask you also about those people who do test positive in San Quentin. As I understand it, they're moved to a place called the Adjustment Center, where typically that was used for solitary confinement. Explain to us more about this Adjustment Center.
So the Adjustment Center has always been a place where it is solitary for those in solitary. So, for example, if someone on Condemned Row in San Quentin, out of the 34, 35 prisons in California, is the only place that houses people that are sentenced to lethal injection. So if somebody has a disciplinary infraction on Condemned Row, the Adjustment Center is the solitary confinement for them. And so what has happened is, as COVID had this flare-up in San Quentin over the past 2 weeks, they have filled the Adjustment Center with COVID patients. However, they only have about 100 bed spaces there, and they're already 300 bodies over, or 300 people over, the amount that they can hold in that Adjustment Center. So now I'm being told that chapel spaces, gyms, and other locations are being used as COVID patient wards, as overflow. But as we've seen, within a matter of week and a half, in San Quentin, that lies in the middle of the Bay Area, in Marin, the flare-up is at 400, which within a week. And we can expect a flare-up to be even higher, coming days. One thing I want to share is a lot of people in society feel like that what happens inside our prison system will not affect them out here in the real world. And I think that is the biggest mistake that
this
we continue to make.
This is KBOO Portland.
Good morning, everybody. Always nice to hear Buffy St. Marie. Yes, we are here by the skin of our teeth. Isn't that the truth? Anyway, I'm Paul Rowland. I am your host on Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm, once again, I think we're going into our fourth month, are we already? Oh, my goodness, of talking to you from my home here in Portland, Oregon, the southeast quadrant. And, things just keep going on at a pace that is truly dizzying. It's always a challenge as a talk show host to first of all feel like that I really have something so important to say that I can take up your hour here. Obviously, I feel that I do, or I wouldn't be doing this. But you know, that the thought does crop in. It's good that I have a lot of different co-hosts and good guests too. Try to bring you lots of different voices. But yes, it is a bit of a challenge to feel like I'm actually in some manner on top of what's going on, in order to have some to sort of focus the subject, perhaps. But I'd like to really hear what you have to say. 503-231-8187. I do have some things that I'm interested in, but I'd like to hear what you have to say. I would really love to hear from people that don't ordinarily call into the show. So you obviously know who you are, and I'd really like to make space for you. I would in particular like to offer this space to marginalized voices in our society, people who for whatever reason aren't given as much of an opportunity to be either represented or to have your voice heard. Of course, what's going on now, and which is what I want to talk about in particular this moment, this Fed uprising, or whatever you want to call it, Black Lives Matter, it's certainly spreading also beyond Black Lives Matter to include a truly decolonial perspective with, if you just focus on a lot of the statues being torn down, specifically in the West here, a lot of colonizers. But I was going to say that people are finding their voices, and I think that is extremely heartening to those of us who deeply believe in social justice and some kind of transformation of this colonial settler, racist colonial settler state, patriarchal settler state that we live in, that has superficially has made some institutional changes over the years, some legal changes, but sort of the bedrock culture has shifted, but there remains a very kind of hardcore racist, patriarchal, homophobic, militarist, exceptionalist mindset that is very, very difficult, as we see in particular in the U.S. Senate. But things there too are changing in the political realm. There's, you know, certainly in the past 10 years, there's been a shift in terms of more people deciding to run for office and making their voices heard there. So my hope, if I have any hope, is that the movements built, you know, that have been exploding on the streets and that have been infiltrating into our corridors of power, certainly not enough, but certainly in a meaningful way, will be able to come together, that we will actually have a real election of some form in the fall that will evidence some form of shift in things at the, you know, certainly at the presidential level. Many of us don't have great faith in Joe Biden, but see him as a potential transitional figure and one that will be more receptive to the voices on the streets, the voices for change, and will allow more voices, more good policies into his administration than the alternative, which I find truly terrible to imagine. It was interesting to hear on The Old Mole on Monday talking, Bill Resnick actually talking to someone about the, you know, the possibility of something I've certainly thought about, I'm sure many of you have thought about, of, you know, what would happen if somehow Trump declares the election null and void. I think there, you know, we're in somewhat uncharted territories. We don't, you know, the idea of a sort of this functional checks and balances democratic system that a lot of us have sort of pinned our hopes on are being shaken. Let's hope that we can actually re-democratize it, rejuvenate it to make it actually work in a better way, because I actually don't see, you know, I am more of consider myself ideologically more of a revolutionary than a reformist, whatever that means. I guess I feel I can sort of hang my hat more on that now, because there's more of a fervor that at least seems to have some sort of potential for a more revolutionary flavor to it. I don't see in terms of the climate issue, which I'm going to talk a little bit about in a few minutes, I'm not sure I see any alternative other than some sort of federal response. I don't see where, certainly the corporate sector doesn't seem to be amenable. Anyway, that's a long introduction to say that the temperature hit 100 degrees in the Arctic. Something very scary is happening in the Arctic. And I know the sort of the momentum that we're feeling is very, very important. And maybe, you know, I'll get back around to that, maybe really the only way to shake things up, even on the climate issue. But I think we do need to keep some attention onto what is going on, because it is, it really doesn't, it needs the kind of attention that maybe the kinds of activism that we're bringing to bear in the Black Lives Matter decolonial moment that we're in may not be up for dealing with. You know, and I feel that tension, that contradiction, or that tension, I guess I would say, very, very acutely, because my soul, my deepest soul, is in this movement in the streets. I've participated in numerous very active civil disobedience, direct action moments and movements, and that's where my heart is. And I really see that as the only way to make serious change happen. But we also have to look at the realities of the physical, geophysical realities that we are in. So I'm just going to read you a little bit from a post from Kevin Hester, who I respect a lot. So what's going on in the Arctic? Heat threatens to destabilize methane hydrates. I'm sure many of you are familiar with these frozen methane that's in the oceans. In particular, the East Siberian Arctic Shelf contains vast vats, gigatons of stored hydrocarbons in the form of these frozen methane. So the Arctic Ocean is heating up in three ways. And of course, we know that the danger of the Arctic heating up faster than the rest of the globe, which is a fact and has to do with particular aspects of our climatological system, there's a vast ability of the Arctic to reflect solar radiation from the frozen oceans is a very, very important shield to the accelerated global warming that's been going on over the past couple decades, increasingly accelerating. I think, you know, 9 out of 10 of the hottest years have been in the last, whatever, I can't keep track of it, but in the last 15 years, we've certainly had, I think, 9 of the 10 hottest years. And so that ability is compromised when there's less and less Arctic sea ice. And the people have been warning for decades about the danger of a blue ocean event. And you know, people have said it have predicted it was going to happen before now. People have predicted it's going to happen, you know, at some point in the future. It's, you know, these very, very complex systems. It's difficult to know. But the fact that the Arctic is heating up so fast right now is a very, very dangerous sign. So, okay, the Arctic Ocean is heating up in three ways. One, sea currents are moving hot water from the Pacific Ocean into the Arctic Ocean. Similarly, sea currents are moving hot water from the Atlantic Ocean into the Arctic Ocean. Two, the Siberian heat wave, which has been going on for over a month, is heating up the sea surface of the East Siberian Arctic Shelf, which I just mentioned a little bit ago. Three, additionally, the heat wave is heating up rivers that carry large amounts of hot water into the Arctic Ocean. And then he goes on to reference some maps that he has on his post. But anyway, so he talks about the risk that heat will penetrate cracks and sediments at the seafloor. Melting of ice in such cracks can lead to an abrupt destabilization of methane hydrates contained in sediments. Furthermore, large abrupt methane releases will quickly deplete the oxygen in shallow waters, making it harder for bacteria to break down the methane, while methane rising through the waters that are shallow can enter the atmosphere very quickly. The situation is extremely dangerous, given the high global warming potential of methane immediately after release. Okay, so what good does it do me to talk about this on the air? I honestly don't know. I mean, really, as I said, I think the best chance for some kind of transformation is what's going on in the streets right now, which has ripple effects. Anytime there's large, there's kind of a return of direct action, as I feel we did with Earth First in the mid-1980s, it has a ripple effect to other people. people, other places, as we see around the world, other issues. So I see this, that the driving force for any kind of change is what's going on right now. I have no power to do so. Even if I did, I wouldn't want to somehow hijack the current moment to bring any other particular agenda. I'm just flagging that what's going on is really, really, really serious. And, you know, we need to at least start talking about it. Biden certainly needs to make it a major part of whatever campaign he's able to muster in these COVID times, which is another thing that's happening that is very difficult to keep abreast of, as obviously our complete failure in federal response and leadership has led to very bad consequences, and has led to a total murkiness of understanding in the American population. Whereas, you know, true leadership could have actually, I mean, really gotten us to a point where actually even this much vaunted economy could have been more robust, if that's what people want, instead of the confusion that's happening, where probably a lot of places are going to have to open up, lock down, open up, because there's no coherence to any kind of response. So anyway, I've already put out a bunch of things. As I said, I would like to hear what is on your mind, and I would really like to hear from people who don't ordinarily call in to the station for whatever reason. 503-231-8187, that's the number to call.
We have a couple of folks have called.
Okay.
I believe John is on the line. Are you with us, John?
Yes.
You're live. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I know that you wanted to kind of talk about the environment, but my call was about the monuments being torn down, whether it be legally or illegally. And now the monuments have gone from, you know, like, well, I would say they were controversial in the first place with Confederacy. But now they're getting into the, well, Abraham Lincoln, Grant, and who knows, whatever, that were sort of the pillars of, you know, Americana. Well, I look at it this way. In 1953, Joseph Stalin died. And he was you already know, he was a brutal dictator and all this kind of stuff. And well, so, right, kind of just sort of after he died, not immediately, but there was a power struggle that was going in the Soviet Union. Well, I think it was the guy who was the head of the secret police there that tried to take over, Gagarin or something like that. But anyway, I'm just to cut it short. Right after that, about 56, 57, they called it de-Stalinization, where every, you know, statue of Stalin or portrait or whatever was completely torn up. This has happened before, like back in Rome and in Egypt too. But getting back to the United States, I see this as a de-Americanization or decolonialization, is like what you put it. In the past, it does not coincide with the present. I think I know that, you know, the past is very important. In fact, I think it's more important than sometimes in the present and the future, because we don't know what the future is. And, oh, gosh, you know, the present, who knows what's going on now? But the past. So I see this as like a de-Stalinization, but it's kind of de-Americanization. You know, get rid of the past. I mean, not really rid of it, but don't glorify it, because the past has been more negative than it has been positive for people who, you know, anybody, but you know, especially Black people and Native Americans. I mean, I was that Andrew Jackson thing going down, I thought that was luscious, you know, because, you know, he, if anybody was a Holocaust, you know, instigator, was Andy Jackson. But that's another point. But I want to make one more point about the Arctic. I've been kind of like reading and hearing on other radio programs that they're saying the next big war is going to be in the Arctic because of the natural resources that are being exposed, like oil and minerals. And already Putin and company are putting the Soviet fleet up there. But anyway, I've talked too much, but I just want to say that this is something that's not new. And if you go back in the history, it's been many times when, you know, this is what you call a turning point of a civilization, or you know, or whatever you want to call it, or a imperial power. But thank you for letting me talk.
No, thank you. Those are all good points. Let us hope it is a turning point, a true turning point towards something very, very different. The open up the Arctic. I mean, I've thought for a long time that there's this perverse race to keep going faster and faster and faster with the exploitative, extractivist economy to somehow sort of, I don't know, well, because that's what it does. At the same time, rushing in the other direction is toward us very fast is the effect, the cumulative effects of this extractivist, productivist, exploitative, profit-driven social economic model. And I just don't, I think you know, as the old Earth First slogan, the nature bats last, is true. And I just think we can't, I think we're, you know, it's the height of insane illusions to think that we're able to keep this thing going as it's going. So anyway, the de-Americanization, I mean, that, you know, that's what the culture war, that's what these boogaloos, these right-wing loonies who are sowing chaos to try to foment a civil war, I believe that's what they're, if I understand their ideology, I think that's what they're after. They want to see some sort of cataclysmic conflict erupt, whereas I think, if I can say, our side wants to see some sort of peaceful transition. I think toppling statues as opposed to shooting police officers to try to foment a civil war, race war, whatever they're trying to do, is a much better way. Of course, they see that, certainly the right wingers sees that as a direct threat to their own, as you said, the pillars. There is something about these statues that is a sort of a foundational, the myth. It's a foundational myth of our culture, you know, the original sins of genocide and slavery that have just, the day of reckoning has been sort of pushed forward, and now people are trying to actually make it come about. Well, again, I wanted to hear what you had to say. Who else we got, Sonia?
All right, I believe Robert's next. Is Robert still with us?
I am.
Go ahead, Robert. You're live.
Good morning, Paul. I'd like to talk about an aspect of this coronavirus that hasn't been discussed. I'm a man, retired, 81 years old. I live in a single-room occupancy building. It's a house. There's three of us here. And I essentially have no safety or control over who comes and goes in this facility. There's another man near my age who is just as concerned for his health as I am, but the landlord introduced a younger man who's, I don't know how old he is, probably in his 30s, who's very socially active and is out running around and mixing with people. But he brings people into this house who we do not know. Now, I share a bathroom with this person, and in the last week, I've had to share the bathroom with four people, and that's four people that I do not know. But I have no legal protection, have no recourse other than to go move into my car and live on the street. And I can barely afford the place I have, or I would rent a house of my own. But
I imagine talking to your housemate hasn't gone over very well.
It has not. He heard me. I said I'd appreciate him doing this socializing maybe at his friend's place rather than here, because we and both the other man and myself have expressed those. We've expressed that to the landlord, who basically hasn't responded one way or the other. He's just been mute. He just says, "Oh, thank you for sharing that."
Well, I don't know if there, if you have, it kind of is a difficult thing because it's such an unprecedented situation. I don't know if you have any recourse to some sort of I don't know, whoever deals with a landlord tenant issues. You might, you know, it might be good for you, even, or just more frustrating, possibly to look into that if you haven't already.
Well, I have, and what they said, yes, this is a whole new aspect that has never come up before,
right.
And there's no law been written about it, and of course I've been trying. Now I've got to talk to state at the state level representatives and senators. And they just went into session today, and the coronavirus is one of the major topics there. But I don't know what the real solution is, but there certainly should be some way. When I rent space to be, you know, that I,
yeah, I think you should bring it to, you know, write an email to the. To people maybe in the city council, I'm not sure what the or the county commission, whatever it's called. I hear you, and I'm sure you're not the only one who's in that or some sort of similar situation in this. You know, people who are forced to go to work and don't get adequate protective equipment, and you know, I'm sure there's people are being exposed against their will in all sorts of ways. I feel for you, and I'm glad you were able to call in, and maybe someone else out there has some ideas about that. But yeah, I'd encourage you to get in touch with, you know, just keep putting out, you know, be the squeaky wheel, because obviously if there's no law, there's no formal policy, you really have no, you know, nowhere to gain traction. So you got to just keep putting it out there.
Yeah, there's nobody I can go to and say you're responsible for my right. safety of my health.
You right,
can make a difference.
That obviously, if we had a different, you know, a different
not addressed in state law.
Uh-huh. Well, listen,
that was what I wanted to call you and just sort of, well, let's make this public. Let's get this issue out there, because there's in Portland. You can go on Craigslist and you get a pretty good idea. There's a lot of, we call them SROs, single room occupancy. And there's a lot of them, and they all express concern that if we interview you, you know, you have to understand that you have to wear a mask and all of this stuff before you can come into our home.
Right. Well, that obviously, yeah, that people are doing that now as it's going on, and I'm sure there's other people who aren't. But thank you for calling in, Robert. Hopefully maybe someone has heard you. And, you know, I don't know, you could even maybe leave your number afterwards with the board op, perhaps, if someone wants to get in touch with you. But, yeah, well, good luck with that, and thank you for bringing it to our attention. All right. This is a Wednesday Talk Radio. We're just about 8:30. I'm Paul Rowland, the host, and we're talking about what you want to talk about. I guess one thing I sort of wanted to run down was talking about this moment we're in. It just really struck me recently that the last 10 years have been actually pretty darn intense in terms of people rising up. You know, we had the Arab Spring, and it kind of spread around the world. We had Occupy. It had ripple effects around the world. We've had the anti-fossil fuel resistance, which has been particularly strong in the Pacific Northwest, which was You know, not risen to the level of a kind of a mass movement, visible mass movement, except in certain marches, climate marches, but has had, you know, major effect. I was actually early on when I came back to the States from Italy. I was on in 2010, I believe it was. It was a march on Blair Mountain against mountaintop removal, which was quite a, you know, quite an important little event in its own right, and was connected up to wider than, you know, in reaction to the killings of mostly younger black men, that has gotten much more attention, mostly because of social media, gave rise to the Black Lives Matter movement. Then there was Standing Rock, which was an incredible long months of building up of resistance, because the strongest show of support for indigenous sovereignty and you know, standing up against environmental destruction that I've seen in my lifetime. And then the you know, hard on that, the Me Too movement, which extraordinary moment of challenging the patriarchal abuse of power, largely in the workplace, but beyond. I just saw the Jeffrey Epstein documentary, which you can find on that streaming service with the word net in it, and that was just horrific. And I was wondering, actually, if the U.S. Attorney Berman, who was just fired in such a ham-handed, ham-fisted way, that he, you know, I wonder if there is some connection possibly. I know he had ongoing investigations on a lot of different fronts, many important ones, including of Trump's some Trump's organizations, Trump's finances, numerous ones. But he was also continuing the Epstein investigation, the pedophile ring that he was kind of at the center of, which is much wider than just him, and nobody else has been publicly named as being investigated. I wonder, you know, except for Prince Andrew, who's refused to come back to testify. So I wonder if there was something there in that. So yeah, it's a, and then of course now with this, some people call the Fed uprising, which really sort of is in a way builds upon maybe all those, and certainly the Trump presidency, COVID has something to do with it, but it's certainly there's certainly some kind of building over this decade, I think. And so this is really our time. This is really the moment to challenge the powers that be. So 503-231-8187 is the number. We got anybody else on stack?
We've got a couple of folks. I believe Camilo is next. Are you still there, Camilo?
Yes.
Go ahead. You're live on air.
Good morning. Hey, I want to go back to something that you said at the beginning of the program, is that we may see the defeat of Trump, and that would be glorious, but that Biden would be kind of a transitional person to the next election. But I mean, I don't think there are any grounds for that, no historical evidence. I mean, if we look at the way the Democrats treated Bernie, look at what happened with the DNC when Keith Ellison ran and was defeated by Perez, who's really awful. I don't have any confidence that the corporate Democrats are going to make it possible for more progressive, more radical, more revolutionary policies.
Well, that's why we have to keep the heat on. That's why the center of gravity has to be moved from the established political parties to something else. At this point, we don't
agree with that.
I just don't see another, in terms of, if you want to, you know, the only thing I see in that is that I do think that I do personally feel like that a change needs to be made in terms of the presidency. I don't know how much weight to put on that, but so if you're going to talk about the presidential politics, that's the way that I would talk about it. But beyond that, you know, I think what the guy who's apparently going to win in the Bronx against the long time 12-term,
right.
16-term congressman, what's I don't know what happened in that Kentucky race with the insurgent candidate, you know,
too close and then, to call.
Yeah, so I don't know. I don't hold out any great hopes, as I said, with the climate change wave washing over us in horrible
fashion.
So this
is my question. I mean, do you vote for Biden? I'm not going to vote for Biden. But,
okay.
I mean, do you support Biden by the argument that he's the lesser of two evils, and if we don't vote for him, that Trump will be reelected? I mean, I have the notion that if Trump is reelected, we're going to have a better chance of making a transition to a more progressive regime than we would if Biden gets reelected and the Democrats are in, and they're going to just take every opportunity to enhance their power that they can.
Well, I think there's arguments to be made on both sides. I can't say I've thought it through fully enough to be able to give you a adequate, pithy response in the particular moment. But I think putting it out there, I think we need to talk about it for sure.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Well, thank you. I should have asked him to clarify a little bit. I'm not sure if that's sort of the accelerate the contradictions argument that, which, you know, certainly in my experience, you know, as I said, I keep talking about this maybe too much, with the Earth First movement back in the 80s was certainly a reaction to a figure that could be compared in some ways, but Ronald Reagan, who tried to totally transform, the administrative apparatus to roll back a lot of environmental legislations to, with Watt as Interior Secretary, and, you know, Earth First sort of rose up as a reaction to that. And then with Clinton, a lot of it died down. In fact, a lot of it was sort of bought off, as Camillo said, the corporate Democrats, who Bill Clinton, speaking of Jeffrey Epstein, is one. And I don't know. That's a discussion, an ongoing important discussion, but I think it needs to be driven by, you know, by people's action, which we're seeing now. Well, with that, what else? Who else is up, Sonia?
All right, I believe Mark, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
All right, go ahead. You're live.
Hey, Mark.
Thanks for taking my call. I wanted a response to several ideas about the financial markets and market distortions. From my perspective, the financial markets represent a sacrificial religion where things become subjects. This is something the media, of course, won't talk about, but we still have a dreadful reality of these financial products that become subjects when we should become the subjects. In other words, we're driven about by microsecond trading and by a financial system that makes itself independent from the real economy and takes money from the real economy and really is much more a religion than an economy, than a real functioning economy. The second point was that the market distortions, including the tax havens and the stock buybacks and insider trading and the microsecond trading, are all realities, and they are never discussed, and they make our system dysfunctional. So these are structural evils that we should discuss, and I suppose KBOO is our place for that discussion.
Well, I had Chris Lehman, I don't know if you recall that or have read his book, The Money Cult, which really lays out in an interesting way how sort of Christianity morphed into this money cult that is sort of an outgrowth of a particular, I guess, sort of heretical form of Christianity, which you kind of see in a really obvious form with this sort of prosperity gospel figures and such.
or the right wing hijacked Christianity, which was in itself a revolutionary movement.
The right wing, I mean, that happened a long, long time ago when it became the Roman state religion. So, I mean, if that's the right wing, you're kind of putting back into the past modern, more modern concepts. But I just want to take briefly issue, we could go at great length about this, the idea, the distinction between the distorted economy and the real economy. I would say it's just the way capitalism works. It's, capitalism mutates. That's what it does. It destroys and mutates, and it in order to create profit, it'll seek whatever forms, methodologies, technologies, you know, as you said, you know, trading currencies like in real time, and you know, taking advantage of time zone differences, and you know, speculative investment on real estate, on whatever speculative investment. I think that's just that's how the real capitalist economy works.
And even when it destroys itself, it's always able to blame the Albanians. Our media is so asleep, so passive, right?
Well, it's part, you know, it's a mindset, you know. It's hard to break free of that mindset. I mean, how many people do you talk to who seem to be, you know, intelligent people who passionately believe in justice and, you know, in sanity and other positive things, aren't able to grasp what's really happening in the economic system. It's not that easy to do.
And Herbert Marcuse, in his great book, The One-Dimensional Man, warned us that the one-dimensional society blocks dissent. And I think we're witnesses to that, you know?
Well, that's why we got to break, you know, that's why we're trying to break the spell with what's happening right now. That's why somehow we got to keep this going and make it, make it something that's, that has a more long-term traction, has the ability to not just topple statues, but topple the giants of Wall Street. You know, that's where the wealth is all, wealth that should be going to changing our, you know, to changing our extractivist, exploitative system is locked up in these hedge funds, in these private equity firms, in these banks, in these big corporations. So we need to get the lever, some sort of traction to be able to, you know, BP after the BP oil spill should have been disbanded, and all its capital should have been gone.
Absolutely.
To truly doing whatever could be done to clean up the Gulf, but that didn't happen because that's the way it is.
I uploaded an article titled "The Escalation of State Power," so I recommend that to you. It's on in Portland Indie Media, and Martin Luther King is quoted in that article saying that the moderate white man who favors order instead of justice is the greatest obstacle to freedom. A great, great quotation, you know.
True enough. Well, listen, thank you for all those good points,
Mark. Thank you.
Appreciate you calling in. It would be really nice to hear from some women, so maybe, Sonia, you could, maybe we could hold off on more male-identified callers. I know that's kind of a harsh strategy to take, I just encourage some women to call. We only have 15 minutes left. And
you know, Paul, in addition to encouraging the women to call, I would encourage the men to step back.
There you go. That's what I meant to say. Thank you. that would be better rather than sort of forcing the issue by telling people that they can't talk on the air. Let's just have some of the men step back and let some women call, hopefully. 503-231-8187. step back, step up. That's what we're talking about. So, yeah, I don't know if people feel like I do that there is some kind of something building, you know, in the past 10 years. Is that just sort of an artificial artifice imposed on you know, or, you know, certainly the righteous rage that is felt is of a kind that I'm not able to summon up because I have not been subject to the brutalities of systemic racism in this culture. My passionate motivations have been others in my life. Well, I take direct action in support of indigenous struggles. I have done that, so I can't fault myself completely. But I guess what I'm saying is it just hasn't, you know, struck on my skin in terms of, you know, gender, sexual orientation, race, etc. And so I think it's what has been happening in the past few years, specifically, as I mentioned, with Standing Rock, Me Too, BLM, and the Fed Uprising, is it that finally these suppressed, oppressed voices, people, are making themselves felt, and it's truly wonderful to see. And I think it's also wonderful to see that more and more allies, mostly younger people, who, as I said, I think last week with Sarah, that there's sort of a generational shift happening. Anyway, I could keep going on. What do people feel about this? 503-231-8187. We got anybody on stack?
Deanna is waiting. Go ahead, Deanna. You're live.
Hey, Deanna.
Now you should be live.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
I'm really glad we're having this conversation. Unfortunately, I didn't come in till 8:30, so you may have already talked about this, but I am very interested in what you have to say, or other people also have to say, about what they see as the potential for what's going on. And first, I would like to say that I completely agree with you that this, I think I agree with what I heard you say, that this kind of direct action is clearly being very successful in getting some attention and some motion. I do fear, of course, that it will be co-opted, and there's showing great signs of co-option or co-optation by corporations who are taking knees figuratively and literally. And I think the next, Nike shoe will say Black Lives Matter or something like that. But anyway, what I wanted to talk about is, or not talk about, but hear about, is where this can lead to, and do you think it has a chance in some way of growing into what I hear many black people saying, that COVID-19, the pandemic paradigm, if you will, that's come to stay, that the climate catastrophe and brutal racism are intimately intertwined, and that this can somehow really address all of that?
Yeah, well, I guess you are asking me to talk about that. I feel as always woefully inadequate. On my first Wednesday show, I actually threw out the question of where people think this is going, because I would like to hear where people, and maybe, you know, you can't. I think there are people who have, you know, it'd be interesting to hear what, you know, someone like Cornel West. You know, I hate to like put certain people forward, but there are people who I hear who certainly are able to articulate this way better than I am, and I have heard, and they do tend to be, you know, black people, indigenous people, women, and people like Angela Davis, who's been around forever.
Yes.
So I mean, I should have someone like that on, but since you're asking me, I will just say, I don't know. It's you know, like I've said on past shows, we've kind of lost the earlier, you know, sort of the whole model of sort of proletarian struggle, which led to such huge movements and revolutions. We sort of don't have that as a sort of binding, overarching, sort of the radical rainbow coalition model, which I sometimes hark to, that that Fred Hampton came up with, had a brief flame. I mean, I kind of see that, but it has to have some kind of, there has to be some kind of organizational coherence to it, which, you know, there sort of seems to be a resistance to that organizational coherence. And like a lot of movements like Occupy, you know, I wasn't there. I haven't been there in Seattle for the CHOP or CHAZ, I don't know, which seems to be now dissipating. So that doesn't seem to be a real workable model. So I don't know. What is the model? Is there a model, or just does it have to take shape spontaneously and we just got to keep trying? I don't. That's a good question.
One of the things that I wanted to share is that if I think we look, all of us who can, look on the internet and find out what black women who are not as well known perhaps as Cornel West are saying. I listened for an hour and a half yesterday to a discussion among three black women. Let's see, it was sponsored by Haymarket Books and the Schomburg Center, and it was called Abolition Teaching. And it was fabulous. And the things that they had to say were remarkably refreshing, and some, you know, I don't want to just quote out of context, but talking about what they're doing and can be done in schools. And, you know, I guess what I see is that if this strength and power can keep up the way it has been, which has totally taken me by surprise. I had no idea this could happen and stay.
You and the rest of us, I think.
Oh, my God. I'm just like, what? Where did this come from? Because this is much bigger, obviously, than the following, if you will, that Bernie had, although I think there must be some of the elements of people who were gathering around Bernie Sanders.
Actually, that's something I didn't mention in my list, that certainly the Bernie Sanders candidacy was also an element in the mix the past 10 years. Yeah.
I've been reading articles that said Bernie Sanders lost a second time. He tried to limit it to class struggle and to people who believe in this government, you know, being able to change this government system to accommodate our desires and demands, health care for all, you know, all the things that were the demands. But these three women who were talking yesterday said, you know, this capitalist system cannot possibly absorb the changes that we need, which I thought was fascinating and worth thinking about more and looking into this more and finding out all the other voices. Maybe
as you said, it can only co-opt the energy and keep going the way it's been going. Yeah.
Yes. So I don't know. To me, the black voices, all of them that are, you know, coming to the surface now, are definitely the leadership. I just hope that the white people who are appearing to be on board with everything stay the mark, because we are the majority, although that's changing fast. And, you know, we have to be the support. We can't let them hang out in the breeze, you know. That's all I've got to think about that. So I just hope, I mean, I'm sending, and other people I'm sure are sending, supplies and money and participating in whatever way we can to support this. Anyway, that's it.
All right. And I think there's an article I just pulled up on my screen, Co-optation as Ruling Class Strategy by Matthew Lyons on a blog, the three-way fight, an insurgent blog on the struggle against the state and fascism. Just read the first paragraph, because it speaks to what you're saying. It's the biggest threat to the U.S. power structure has faced in many years, a black-led multiracial wave of protests, uprising, and strikes against the police and white supremacy in cities across the country. Defenders of the established order have responded with a variety of countermeasures, including direct police repression, vigilante violence, and propaganda campaigns designed to demonize, divide, and weaken the movement. Another countermeasure that's received less attention is co-optation, not just immediate small-scale tactics such as mayors proclaiming Black Lives Matter or cops taking a knee, but large-scale strategic efforts to channel mass rage into limited changes that leave existing systems of power, hierarchy, and oppression fundamentally intact. This kind of co-optation isn't coming from the White House It may be beyond the capacity of the Democratic Party leadership, but is a force we need to contend with. And it goes on and on. That speaks directly, I think, to what you were talking about.
That's it. That's it, yeah. I just to say, and then I get off and let someone else speak. Angela Davis recently said, look, and this is my, of course I'm following what she says. She says, look, there's only one reason to vote for Joe Biden, and that is because there is more opportunity to keep the pressure on when it's them in power than the Republicans, and Trump is causing even more trouble than just normal Republicans, as we know, because he's such a... Anyway, so, yeah, I take issue with the person who said, I won't vote for Joe Biden. Look, this is not about who you think will be good. It's about strategy. It's about where can we apply pressure the best, to a snarling cat or a little kitty cat or a, you know, a whole pack of dogs. And that's what I'm thinking about. So thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Deanna. Always good to hear from you. It's been a while. And I just want to cite a book that Matthew Lyons cited, Black Awakening in Capitalist America, an Analytic History by journalist-turned-academic Robert L. Allen, which I guess talked about how the U.S. ruling class responded to the African-American urban uprisings of the 1960s. So that's could be an interesting, valuable resource. Black Awakening in Capitalist America, an Analytic History by Robert L. Allen. We've only got about 4 minutes left. Sonia, we got any last caller?
Well, do we want to try to squeeze another Robert in?
Oh, sure, why not?
Okay, all right, hold on. You're up next. Go ahead, Robert, you're live.
Yeah, I just wanted to call in. You want to talk about strategically voting. Voting Joe Biden is not only allowing the Democrats to think that they can rig elections, which, you know, the 1044 thumb drives worth 10 gigabytes worth of votes that weren't counted. The Democrats didn't want the polling stations in Texas. The amount of voting rigging that the Democrats did, Joe Biden being a racist and a rapist for the most part, SDK, which is supporting him, was also, you know, he's hired Anita, who was the PR person for Weinstein.
So what's your alternative?
Well, here's the thing. The Democrats literally are expecting us to just be like, well, we have to do this, and that's how we do it. So I think if we grew a backbone and stood up for, if I voted for what I believe in instead of the lesser two evils, we wouldn't be in this mess if everybody did that. That's how they're doing this control. They've done it since the 50s. I mean, you can look up how the Democratic or even the Republican, what they do is they take these people running and they, you know, they rig it. Anyway,
okay. So we've got a third position after Camilo and Deanna's. So they've got a wide variety of opinions, in particular on the presidential, which, you know, may or may not be the most important aspect of the upcoming elections, and the elections may or may not be as important as what people are doing in the streets.
That's what I think works. Direct action gets stuff done. It's gotten more done than voting ever has.
Okay.
2 or 3 weeks, my opinion. But here's where we need to strategically think. Oregon always votes Democrat. I think if we're going to start taking you know, progressives serious, they're going to have to stray away from the Democratic Party. They've proved time and time again that this isn't it. And I need to remind people, here's the most frustrating thing for the past 4 years. I've been heavily involved in Occupy Wall Street, Black Lives Matter, the first one, the Dakota Access Pipeline. All that was under the Obama administration. I would feel like an idiot if I had to vote for Joe Biden, because we all have to vote blue no matter who, even if they can't function, which is what the Democrats got. And now we're now, you know, he gets in and I'm going to have to be organizing and rallying and doing all these things, you know, that I am against. You know, I'm going to have to be organizing, you know, once Joe Biden gets in there too. So I'm not going to.
Well, I think we'll be doing that no matter what, because that's the nature of the capitalist order that we live in. So, Well, keep on keeping on. That's all I got to say. I think we run out of time, Robert, so thank you for calling. Appreciate it. All right. Just have a few seconds left. I just want to say I've enjoyed this, and I appreciate the people who've called. I appreciate everybody who's tuned in. And if you haven't supported KBOO this year, I think it might be a good time to do that. Go to kboo.fm and click on that old donate button. We are your community radio listener-sponsored station. That's how we keep going. And we really appreciate that support. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Ta-ta. Thank you, Sonia. Look right now, and you will see we are only here by the skin of our teeth as it is. So take heart and take care of your link with life. It's beautiful. If you got the sense to take care of your source of perfection, Mother Nature, she's the daughter.
Homelessness is traumatic. I think we need to first and foremost put that on the table. It is inhumane. It is something that nobody should have to experience. And it's something that way too many of our neighbors are forced to do every single night for lack of affordable housing and lack of